what I see evolving currently on large scale is the highest level of unmet need in society that I've ever experienced in my lifetime. And it's sad and it's terrifying all at the same time. We are seeing patients enter our system more debilitated, sicker, more comorbidities, while at the same time having fewer resources and oftentimes competing concerns around substance use, socioeconomic limitations, and often homelessness as well. That it is increasingly difficult environment to get people's needs met.
What if I told you there's a collaborative relationship-focused therapy making positive impacts on thousands of lives across Vermont and northern New York every year? This healthcare discipline helps people stay independent, navigate illness and injury, recover from traumatic events, and practitioners work with people of all ages and walks of life, helping them adapt to their environments and maintain or recapture health and well-being across a wide range of goals and ability levels. Occupational therapy is a familiar part of many medical journeys, and today we'll sit down with occupational therapists and their patients to learn more about the vital role it plays in helping people regain independence and improve quality of life. Welcome to Living Healthy Together, where we're talking about occupational therapy and celebrating OT Month, which is April, and the work that these folks do across a wide variety of injuries and issues that people experience. We're joined now by Janet Conk, an occupational therapist at UVM Medical Center, and Brian Stevens, a father and Vermonter who suffered a traumatic injury and has worked with Janet to regain function and rehab himself from those injuries. Brian and Janet, thanks so much for joining us. Brian, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about the injury that brought you into the hospital and how you eventually met Janet.
I was in a devastating motorcycle accident that left me paralyzed from the chest down. During the accident, I punctured a lung. I had a concussion, several broken ribs. And yeah, it left me paralyzed. I spent about 3 weeks in the actual hospital. Two of those weeks were in ICU. And then that's when I was transferred into Fannie Allen Rehabilitation, where I got to meet Janet.
Talk a little bit about your experience suffering these traumatic injuries and what it was like for you. There are physical challenges, but there's also emotional and mental challenges. Can you give folks a sense of what it's like to go through something like this?
It was rough. I dealt with really severe pain. I injured my shoulders in the accident, which left it very difficult in the beginning stages of my treatments to be able to roll over in bed, lay in bed. It was a lot of pain with that many broken bones. And through the course of my rehab, I had come a long way, which going through those steps and seeing progression kind of brightened my spirit and let me know that there was hope that I was gonna be able to progress. And I did.
Janet, how did you meet Brian for the first time? Where was he at in his recovery when he came to occupational therapy and met you?
When Brian came, like he said, we were dealing with a lot of pain, like rolling in bed, breathing, coughing, all of that was pretty painful. It was really trying to relearn your center of balance for a while. We couldn't even sit up without support. It was starting from scratch, trying to get to the edge of the bed, trying to propel a wheelchair, trying to keep your balance while turning your head and learning what it's going to be like to live with a spinal cord injury. It's a lot to process in that first few days. And Brian, you handled it better than others. And he would be like, all right, what are we doing? What are we doing today?
Why do you think that was, Brian? If it were me, I would be devastated and I would be depressed. And I don't know that I would be able to do things to actually attack the problem and try to progress.
In the beginning, it was a little depressing, you know, not being able to sit up on my own or do anything, really. I needed a lot of help with every step, and I've always been a very independent person. I've never liked asking for help, and to need help doing everything in my daily routine, it was mentally challenging for me and physically. And I guess I didn't really realize how far my gains had come until towards the end. Looking back, when I was able to do all these things on my own, playing ball with Janet, sitting up on my own, transferring.
Remember the day that you got your socks and shoes on by yourself?
Yeah. And, you know, that was a big accomplishment. It's like, look at me, everybody. I can put my own shoes on.
I remember you screaming that in the gym.
So towards the end, it was really nice looking back over the course of the 4 weeks to see how far I had come. And I had an excellent team, PT, OT, the nurses, everybody was really great. And I had come a long way in a short amount of time.
And I think a lot of what acute rehab does is, one, you have to be able to tolerate the intensity of 3 hours or more of therapy. And I think a lot of what we do is not just like OT, it's like 30% OT, 30% problem solving maybe, and 30% being a cheerleader or like a motivational speaker.
Where does occupational therapy fit in this spectrum? There's the acute care that Brian received in the hospital. There's physical therapy and there's occupational therapy. What is the focus of occupational therapy vis-a-vis all of these other services that are happening?
So OT, we kind of focus more on function and getting someone to feel human again versus a patient. And it can be after recovering from a stroke or a traumatic brain injury or spinal cord injury or just multi-trauma or extended ICU stay where you're just so debilitated. And we focus on, one, teaching either compensatory strategies to do all those activities of daily living, whether it's getting dressed or toileting or brushing your teeth or transferring or figuring out equipment that you're going to need for when you go home, cooking a meal. And there's a big umbrella of things that OT does, cognition and vision and all that other stuff. So yeah, if someone is not able to stand, we're going to teach you how to get your pants on in a different way. Or if someone can't see things on the left side, we're going to adapt your environment. So it's a lot of adaptability and kind of meeting people where they are when they come to us in rehab. We're like life hackers, but with a medical degree.
That sounds really complex because there's a technical aspect to it, right? Everyone probably has been through that exercise where they sit you down and they say, you're talking with someone who's never walked before. Explain how to walk. And then you try to write instructions for how to walk. And through that exercise, you realize this is really complex to try to explain. Is that an aspect of OT, or is it not quite as technical as that in terms of how you help people?
It is as technical as that, but I would say we kind of fragment steps down. So someone with a spinal cord injury who's not going to walk, we're going to fragment the steps so that they learn, one, how to get to the edge of the bed, two, how to set up their wheelchair, and then three, your like body mechanics to get from your bed to your wheelchair so that you can go on about your day with your wheels.
Brian, what was the most impactful part of OT for you?
I guess what really stands out to me is the day my 12-year-old daughter was able to come into OT with me. And I sat on the edge of the bed balancing by myself, and I was able to throw ball with my 12-year-old daughter without falling over.
That's right. I remember that. And then we even made it harder. I had her moving from side to side.
Yeah, that stands out the most to me.
I think what people don't realize is when you don't have sitting balance, how much that impacts everything you do. You can't lean forward to spit into the sink when you're brushing your teeth. You can't lift your hands up to do something, put your hat on or put a shirt on over your head because you're kind of falling all over the place. And Brian definitely came in with a can-do attitude, but Brian was also the type of guy where I had to read his face because he would never tell me when his pain level was too high. So that's another big thing with therapy, is getting to know somebody at a much quicker speed and a deeper level than, I mean, people come to us and we never meet them for a good reason, right? No one ever comes to acute rehab for a good reason. So the emotional piece to all of this, too, I think is something to really point out what everyone has to go through in rehab, and definitely seeing a person as a human and not just the patient.
I can tell that you guys have a great relationship. Brian, what was it like getting to know Janet? And did you see and feel the impacts of having that relationship on your therapy?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I had a bond with Janet day one. She had a great laugh. She was able to joke around with me. I've always had a sense of humor. I like to joke. So during our session, she never knew what my blood pressure was. So I could joke with her and be like, boy, feeling lightheaded. She'd run and grab the blood pressure kit. And sure enough, it was right down in the 40s.
Brian, in the beginning, when you have a spinal cord injury, there's something called also stasis, where your blood pressure drops when you get up for the first time. And I forgot all about that, Brian. You were constantly fainting on us every time we sat you up. And then it did. It became a joke where he would be like, oh, I'm starting to feel a little dizzy, just to see me freak out a little bit. Hurry, go get the pillows.
So being able to joke around was definitely a big part of my healing.
I think it should be a big part of everybody's healing. However, not everyone is at that point when they get here. And that's a big thing with rehab, meeting people where they are, I think, is to read it. And it was so much fun. I feel like Brian and I's personalities meshed really perfectly. And it was easy to kind of, because you get deep and personal with people, and not just like about their personal life, but what they have to do in order to get back home. With spinal cord injuries, toileting is a big thing. And you got to get deep in there and get to really know somebody. And doing it with humor is always a lot easier.
Brian, what was the scope of your acute rehab program?
I was supposed to be in there for 4 weeks. And coming up on that 4 weeks, they realized that I was still making progress daily. And due to like some infections and health issues, they let me stay in an extra week, which I was ready to get out of there at that point. But at the same time, it was good to stay the extra week because I made that much more progression.
And I think also for someone like Brian or anybody who's leaving at a significantly different level of independence than they were before, a big role that we do here is also caregiver training. So talking to family members and showing them, hey, make sure that his brakes are locked or his feet are in the right position or before he does his popover transfers or he's going to need help with X, Y, and Z. Spinal cord injuries are a whole nother ball game versus just like a broken hip.
Janet did a great job at bringing my family members up to speed, who I currently reside with, at helping me out, because it's been a fairly smooth transition, I must say, having family support and Janet explaining to them how to help me, transferring into the shower, to my bed. Janet made it clear to them that I was not to be transferring at all on my own. For a good few weeks until I got comfortable with it.
How long has it been since the accident, and what's your life like today, and what's next for you?
That's a great question. So my motorcycle accident was July 6th of 2025, and I'm still making progress to this day. It's been a while, and Janet, plug your ears, but I've been able to go out snowmobiling this winter. I have been downhill skiing at Jay Peak 3 times. I have been swimming with outpatient therapy. Let's see here. I'm learning my wheelies on my wheelchair. Yeah, so I've been able to get out and do things. And you asked me what my plans are here forward. I've always been a very active individual, so I'm trying to get into more adaptive sports. I hope this summer I can do the hand cycling with other groups of handicapped people, kayaking. I want to get out there and do the things I love to do. You know, this injury isn't going to stop me from living my life. And it seems like I can do just about anything I want to do. It just presents a little more of a challenge. And, you know, life was a little too easy before anyway, so who doesn't like a good challenge?
That is such an amazing perspective, sir. You have an indomitable spirit. Thank you both so much for joining us. Brian, thank you for sharing your story. Janet, thank you for sharing your insight and expertise. It's time for a quick break. When we come back, we'll sit down with a clinical leader on UVM Medical Center's occupational therapy team and hear more about rising demand for these services and the broad scope of practice that occupational therapists provide to people of all ages and walks of life. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome to Living Healthy Together, where we're celebrating occupational therapists and occupational therapy and its important and impacts across our region. We're joined now by Greta Irwin, a licensed occupational therapist and multi-site manager for physical therapy and occupational therapy, and a host of other specialties within those scopes of practice for UVM Medical Center. Greta, thanks for joining us. This is one of those Russian nesting doll topics where it's super important, super impactful, and most people, myself included, have absolutely no idea what kind of impacts it makes. So let's start at the very basic level. What is occupational therapy within this big scope of services? Physical therapy, speech language pathology, occupational therapy, acute care. It's all part of a big continuum of care.
Absolutely. Well, OT is a little different than what most people think of because OT really looks at the entire human being, the whole person. And one of our very first goals when we meet a new patient or client is to really understand what matters to them. When we deal with injury, disability, or disease, it usually translates to a loss of function. And when we lose function, that means that we may not be able to fulfill our roles in life. When we lose the ability to operate normally, that has far-reaching consequences for not only ourselves, but the people that rely on us. So occupational therapy intervenes in that space to help people reconnect independently to their roles and their ability to care for themselves and their families.
Maybe I'm wrong here, but the word occupational in occupational therapy, I wonder if that makes people misapprehend, oh, this is something for someone who's experienced an injury on the job or something like that. But occupational therapy can touch your life no matter where your injury happened. These things don't have to be related to a job or a vocation. They can be anything.
That's absolutely right. And that is a common misconception. In occupational therapy speak, occupation means purposeful activity. So instead of focusing on vocation, it's really an expansion of all we do as humans that is purpose-driven, whether that's being able to bathe and dress yourself or being able to operate a large piece of equipment or navigate your day-to-day schedule without confusion. It's all of those things and much more.
I love that lens that you put it through. These are very human things, right? The very basic things that turn into these really complex things. What's it like to learn or to have to learn to walk again? What's it like to have to learn to use your hand again in a different way or to use your other hand because you can't use the one that you normally use? These are really traumatic things. What drew you to this line of work?
To this work early. I just personally kind of fell out of the womb being very focused on a service-oriented life. And at a very young age, actually the day I turned 16, I started a job in a local nursing home as a nurse's aide. and quickly gravitated toward the rehabilitation team in that space and learned about occupational therapy for the first time as a 16-year-old. And it just kind of caught my attention and grew on me. And I went directly to college to pursue that degree as soon as I graduated from high school. So it's a wonderful way to offer very meaningful, life-affirming care.
How big is the team and what kind of specialty care does the team provide?
The scope is tremendous, and OTs work in all kinds of spaces. Here in the hospital system, we might intervene in the emergency department if somebody comes in with an injury or having experienced a functional decline. So we might go in to consult and make a recommendation to get somebody back home safely. When somebody comes into the acute care hospital, depending on what their injury or illness is, OT will be ordered to start intervening as they are recovering from whatever that event is and helping them at that phase of the game with the basics, being able to get up out of bed, being able to navigate their mobility and their self-care. And maybe it is to rehabilitate those abilities, or in some sometimes we have to choose to compensate or adapt. So that is another whole realm of OT. We have a whole host of strategies that we can teach people to navigate barriers. We also prescribe all kinds of equipment to replace strategies or physical abilities that a person used before they were injured. An example might be somebody with severe arthritis that can't use their hands well anymore, but they want to continue to live independently, but have difficulty with turning water faucets on and off, or opening jars, or the knobs on a stove. We can connect people with tools to help them replace the skills or abilities that they have lost.
Can you talk about the connection between an OT and their client or their patient? It's got to be really strong, because this is a person that is independence, right? You've said the word independence a couple times now. That's so important to people. And that's part of your job, is to help them reclaim that.
Absolutely. I think some of the very best OTs that I have worked with are those that enter the patient relationship in a way that signals to every individual that you are here to serve them, that you are here to understand what is most meaningful to them, and that you are on their team and it is them that is driving their goals. So it's really starting a conversation that demonstrates that you are interested in learning about what that patient wants as a way to build rapport and gain trust, because you're going to be working in some very intimate situations with some of your patients, depending on what their functional level is at the time that relationship starts. Obviously, if you're helping somebody learn to bathe themselves again, that a level of intimacy that is atypical for most therapeutic relationships. So OTs need to be not only very aware of what their patients' needs are, but aware of themselves, how to maintain appropriate boundaries, and to meet every patient at their need level.
Let's talk about the level of need broadly. What are you and your team seeing, and what have you seen over the last 5, 10 years? What's the trend line here for OT services?
That is a loaded question. And of course, my observations are uniquely my own. But what I see evolving currently on large scale is the highest level of unmet need in society that I've ever experienced in my lifetime. And it's sad and it's terrifying all at the same time. In the wake of COVID, where we are seeing patients enter our system more debilitated, sicker, more comorbidities, while at the same time having fewer resources and oftentimes competing concerns around substance use, socioeconomic limitations and often homelessness as well. That it is increasingly difficult environment to get people's needs met. So, you know, I find myself leaning in even harder to look for any and every opportunity that I can turn up to create the ability to meet those needs.
Are there clear and demonstrably effective investments that can or should be made, whether it's something like the Vector robot, which we've profiled on the show before, or other machines that help people be safer and get better gains in their recovery? Is that helpful, or is that just a piece of a bigger puzzle that doesn't have a straightforward answer to it?
I think some of both is the answer. I've relied very heavily on applications and wearables and things like that, especially amongst the brain injury survivor population, where the need for external structure, external cues is very profound. So that type of technological enhancement is extraordinarily helpful in those spaces. There are also limitations in those spaces as well, because, again, I have to go back to that intimacy piece, that when somebody's purpose, their ability to do their purposeful activity is disrupted, there is a cascade of psychosocial implications that come along with that. And sometimes trying to shove technology into that space, and again, this is an opinion of mine, creates more social isolation for those individuals than it gives them better functioning, better independence, better outcomes, and their personal goals. So it's a little bit of balancing and choosing the things that are meaningful and appropriate, but not overdoing it.
Thank you for coming on the show to talk about all of this and give people kind of a launching pad for the rest of the hour here. That's Greta Irwin. We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're digging into occupational therapy and its impact on lives across our region. We're joined now by Heidi Fonts, a pipefitter and resident of Fletcher, Vermont, and Krista Schestag, an occupational therapist and certified hand therapist at UVM Medical Center. Heidi, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about the medical journey that you've been on and what brought you into the hospital to receive occupational therapy.
It was a beautiful summer day, August 7th. It was later morning. I was sitting on a 5-gallon bucket. I was drilling a hole. And all of a sudden, things didn't go so well. My glove that I was wearing got stuck in an M18 Milwaukee drill.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I mean, it startled me. But I think shock had already kind of set in. I took my glove off and saw that I could move my finger around in ways that didn't move before. And so I walked down to the basement where my work partner was and just held my hand up and told him that we needed to get to the hospital, which was right down the road. Luckily, we were right in Winooski, right down from the medical center. And he is a firefighter and he went white when he saw me. So I kind of started to feel the severity of it, but not really at all. I helped break out of the truck and felt fine, just kept going. And it wasn't until we got to the hospital that I started to feel kind of lightheaded. It started to kick in and they relocated. Well, they took x-ray of my pinky because that was the one that was obviously damaged. It was going in a different direction. And when they asked me to move my ring finger out of the way, I couldn't move it. So they ordered x-rays for that one. Both of them were dislocated. The amazing doctor relocated them without any numbing. And then when he turned my hand over, he saw there was blood and asked where the blood came from. I didn't know I was bleeding.
And that's when he saw some of the bones sticking out, from what I understand. So I got 4 stitches, so I did get numbing at that point. Drove home. I mean, the shock was pretty powerful. And then I took that day off, and then I took Friday off. And then I was going to go back to work Monday, but I was having a reaction to the antibiotics. So I took that Monday off and went back to work Tuesday.
You know that you're in to something serious when you've turned to Firefighter White. Those guys don't get shook up too easily. You've been a pipe fitter for many years. Obviously, your hands are really important to you, and injuries and scrapes, bangs, bruises, those kinds of things come with the territory. Was this the worst mishap that you've been involved in your career?
This was definitely the most traumatic. It took a long time for me to realize that I was hurt. Even I thought I was going to be able to just be fine in a week. So when you're in the trades, or, you know, if you're stubborn, you just want to keep going. And so you just keep going, like, yeah. Farmers.
What was it like for you? There are stages, right, to these things. There's the shock, and then there's all of the stuff that comes after it. Talk about the process that you went through in your healing journey.
Luckily, it was my left hand, which is my non-dominant hand. I kind of thought that I was going to be okay. I was going to be able to carry on and do all my things. You just don't realize how much you use all parts of your body until all of a sudden there are just so many things I couldn't do with it. I couldn't open a door. I couldn't, and I'm not very good at asking for help either. So that was a lesson to me that I've got to learn how to be better at that. So I feel like when something happens, there's something to learn, and I've learned a lot. But not having that hand, you know, putting the blinker on hurt my driving. It was, but it didn't hurt unless I used it. So, like, you don't miss your teeth until you start chewing. It's just all of a sudden life changed really quickly. But the shock of the physical and the lifestyle change was still something I guess I was in denial about for a very long time. And that's when OT comes in.
Krista, tell me how you met Heidi. Was there anything that jumped out to you about Heidi or about her case right off the bat? Or did it take a while for you and her to kind of grow together as a patient and a hand therapist?
I met Heidi at our orthopedic rehab center. We work directly with the surgeons and the physician's assistants in upper extremity orthopedics. So throughout the week, each of the 9 hand therapists will have what's called a walk-in clinic, and we're available. We have no other scheduled patients. We're available for any post-op patients that might come over from those providers. And we will make them orthoses. We'll begin their range of motion. And then we'll set them up for scheduled appointments, typically once a week, to follow them through their rehab journey. So I think Heidi was originally scheduled with another therapist. And for whatever reason, her and I ended up together for one session. And she was like, no, I only want to work with you now.
Does that happen a lot?
Not a lot, but it certainly happens where you just have a better therapeutic relationship with someone. Your personalities just fit better to allow for the best possible outcome. Some people need a little stricter drill sergeant type personality. Others really need to know all about the anatomical things that are going on. Others just need to be told it's going to be okay. There's nothing wrong. We're going to get a good outcome. This hand's going to be functional. So yeah, patients will decide, I think this clinician's the right fit for me, and I would love to just continue my care with them.
That's a really amazing piece of this that if you're not in it, you probably don't think about. You have the ability to pick the member of your care team. That's not something you get in every facet of your healthcare.
That is one really great thing too about our clinic, is that we do have so many clinicians. And one thing with Heidi, I had never done serial casting before. Heidi needed serial casting done. So I had one of the more seasoned therapists come over with me that session. She serial casted Heidi, showed me how to do it, and then I was able to replicate that care the additional weeks.
What is serial casting?
So serial casting is like a plaster. You put it, it's a almost like a sheet, like a piece of tape of plaster, and you put it in water, and then you wrap it. Heidi had boutonniere deformities more prominent on her ring finger, and so I did serial casting on that for a number of weeks. And that's where she wears that essentially cast. You can't get it wet. It's just on all the time for a week. And then you return to the clinic and I cut it off. We do some light grabbing activities to try to get that flexion back, that bend in her fingers. And then we would apply another cast. And you can do that for 4 to 6 weeks and see how that goes.
Heidi, tell me what you remember about the first time you met Krista.
My first impression was just kindness. I'm going to start crying. Sorry. It's just so powerful to have somebody that can meet you, because it's not just physical. It's obviously very mind and emotion. Getting the shock, the denial, the fear of, you know, future use, all these things. And the way they meet the patient with just openness and without judgment, being realistic, setting down realistic expectations and reaffirming that it was a traumatic incident was really important to me. And I cried a lot with her because there's a lot of information that my body was giving me that I had to relay to her, and the patience that she had and the compassion and empathy. It was just so, my impression, just her smile, her sense of humor. She's a dream.
It's wonderful that you were able to find a partner in healthcare for this process. I don't think that happens for everyone. Rehabilitation is never a straight line. What was the most challenging part for you, and what was the most rewarding part?
The most challenging part was probably the serial casting, because I have boutonnieres. I call my boutonniere souvenir, but it's boutonniere deformity. Where she was doing her best to get my finger straight as they could. Because right now, after all this time, I'm at 18%. So just doing the dishes, showering, just trying to keep it dry. That was really challenging for me. She gave me a bunch of exercises. I have so many props that I got sent home with, and just to keep working on. It was the frustration of it, because your mind is telling your body to do something and your body's not doing it. Like the old folks boogie song by Little Feat, like your mind tells your body to do something, you just won't do it. That was really hard. But the paraffin dips that I got, those were the most satisfying. It just felt really good.
There's such a broad scope of things that we could talk about. What are things that people can do at home, whether it's to prevent an injury or to rehab themselves? Are there things that you recommend the general public do if you work with your hands in whatever capacity?
Don't text like this. Get a pop socket where you can rest your hand. I would say that's probably number one. Number two is really, it's not no pain, no gain. If you are having pain when you're trying to rehab an injury, that is your body telling you, I'm not ready to do that yet. You're potentially causing some swelling. You can have interstitial swelling up to 30%, and that's causing some damage and you need to slow it down. Yes, reach out to your healthcare provider, your PCP, if you're having something like an arthritic flare. There are a lot of things that hand therapists can do. Prevention is just as helpful as rehab is.
This has been a really fascinating conversation. Thank you, Heidi, for sharing your story. This stuff is not easy to talk about. And thank you, Krista, for the insight and tips on hand health. It's time for a break. When Living Healthy Together comes back, we'll sit down with an author, storyteller, and professor at the University of Vermont whose lifelong medical journey recently took her to the Driver Rehabilitation Program at UVM Medical Center, where she connected with an occupational therapist who helped preserve her independence and mobility. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're talking with patients and occupational therapists across a wide range of healthcare journeys. And we're joined now by Dr. Sefakor of University of Vermont and Heather Zook, an occupational therapist at University of Vermont Medical Center. Thank you both for joining us and sharing your stories and insights today. Dr. Sefakor, let's start with you. What brought you to occupational therapy?
That question is very broad. I will start from a long time ago that I had polio at the age of 8. So polio affected my left leg. So I used to walk with braces and crutches. And then also back from 2006, I have not been walking because I fell, which affected my right leg also. What actually brought me to hither is I just developed, I don't know, there is no name for it, but I had this severe shoulder pain on my right hand. I was in my office grading students' papers, and then I felt that sharp pain in my shoulder. And I thought it was a joke. I ignored it in some few minutes after, around 10 to 15 minutes. I thought of what, going to the bathroom. And that's in the bathroom. That was when I realized that it wasn't something to brush over. In the bathroom, because now I'm in the wheelchair, normally in the bathroom, I have to carry myself with my strong arms. So I was able to go to pee. And after, I couldn't carry myself again to the chair. That was the journey for me. And that day, I remember I called one of my faculty members to come and help me. She came to the bathroom. It was a hard nut to crack to carry me to the chair. So long story short, my friend accompanied me to the hospital emergency that day, and they said I had a lot of tendon tears in my shoulder. I have this severe shoulder pain on my right side. Now I can't use my right hand to drive. I used to drive with my right hand, and now even I used to drive with my leg, and then I can't drive with my leg anymore. And now I can't drive with my right anymore. So my coming to the hither, it's about that training that will help me to drive with my left hand.
That is really a complex journey and a lifelong journey. Can you talk about the mental and emotional impacts and fortitude that you found throughout your life? How did you find resilience and recovery?
That's a good question. I think I got my strength from my mother, or my late mother, who was very sure and intentional to build me or to psych me spiritually. My mom was very staunch Christian. She was very intentional. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So when people ask me that question, I answer that I pray a lot, because I just believe that because of prayers, I wouldn't have gotten here. So my resilience, my tolerance level, my everything, I just lean in the spirit. So I do a lot of prayers. I sing a lot. I dance a lot. Yes, those are some of the things that I do easily. I actually wrote my memoir. I wrote a book about myself, because even when I'm talking to my students, that this happened to me, this happened to me, this happened, they don't believe it. They're like, and you still smile? And you are still happy like this? I say, yeah. That is the only place that I draw my energy from.
Heather, what do you remember about meeting Dr. Sefakor for the first time? What sticks with you when you think about your work together?
Well, it's been really fun and colorful. When I first met Sefakor, she came in the room and she said, I need to figure out how I'm going to drive, and I'm going to need a van, and I need to make this happen, but I don't have any money for a van right now, but I think it's going to happen. And at first, I didn't believe that we were going to be able to figure that out. But it's amazing. I think her faith in God and people, things actually work out. And she has proven me wrong. And I have great faith now. I mean, things actually worked out wonderfully, that we were able to make everything work. And she reminds me every day that where there is faith and where there is motivation and hard work, you can get things done. When you want something really badly and when you believe in things, you can make things possible and make things happen. And I love that about Cefacor. When I first met Cefacor, she didn't have the shoulder problems. The first day I met you, Cefacor, you didn't have that happen with your shoulder. I met you in January, and then you had the shoulder thing happen to you. And so we had to shift how we were going to do your driving.
Yeah.
And so I think part of occupational therapy is going with the flow and learning how to adapt to what abilities you have and learning to flex. And I think over the last year, we have learned to flex to the abilities that you have. And you've shown that you've been able to learn how to drive with adaptive equipment that meets your needs. And now you're driving.
Heather, driving rehabilitation and adaptive driving technology is not a narrow thing. There's probably a wide variety of technologies. There's a wide variety of challenges that people have to overcome when they're relearning to drive or learning to drive a different way. How many different ways are there to do this?
Driver rehabilitation can be no technology at all, just evaluating someone to see if they're ready to be a driver as a brand new driver or someone that's been through an illness or a disability to see if it's safe to get back to driving, to low-tech equipment such as hand controls or adaptive mirrors or adaptive seating, or looking at adapting a vehicle so it can accommodate an assistive device like a wheelchair or walker or things like that. And then as high tech as driving with a joystick or drive-by-wire. And the technology is constantly changing. So I'm constantly needing to update myself with what's out there for adaptive equipment. So with technology advances, we're constantly needing to upgrade our knowledge. And with self-driving cars, that's going to change the driving world for people with disabilities. So I think things are going to keep changing every year with what's out there for people with disabilities. And it's going to change our ability to increase access to getting into vehicles.
What was the moment in your work with Heather that you felt like a corner was turned, or you were finally overcoming the current challenge that had manifested itself for you?
Working with Heather has been a very fun journey, because anytime that I'm going to her, I just know that I'm going to make a progress. And she was very patient. We were doing book work, like learning the things before going on the field. And some, I just come back and I totally forget. Then I realized that the patience piece was one thing that was so helpful for me. After my lessons, I have to record and even take videos. I like taking pictures a lot, take video about myself and take videos of what I learned. So she wasn't rigid. She just knew that I needed that badly so that I can revise back home, because every day I learn new things. And when it came to the time where we have to try different gadgets, you know, I tried so many different gadgets, and then I have to accept one. There was a time I accepted that I think I like the right one, but upon a second thought, I realized that I have to be thinking in my left mind. So it was very hard from the beginning for me, because at times she would just say, take right, and I'll go taking left. Can you imagine somebody who drove before? So I have to learn around or build around her patience, and also learn new things around the fact that she has the time and the patience for me. And learning the new tools was very impactful for me. That now I'm a pro in everything, because I passed my road test with no blemish.
One of the things I've heard a few different times now talking with patients and occupational therapists is that goal setting is really important, and keeping yourself motivated is really important. What advice do you have for others out there who maybe they're struggling with driving, maybe they're struggling with other things that occupational therapy can help with? How can they set goals for themselves and keep themselves motivated?
I would just say that they have to be open-minded and be very truthful. Culturally, some of us, we are not open to talk about certain things, especially the type of disabilities that we have. It's not that easy for people from other cultures to just say, like me, that's my work. I have students who have, very physical disabilities, but they tell me, no, I'm not a person with disability. That is one thing. Like, you see very clearly that they deny themselves of that reality. And if you don't understand some of the cultural practices of the people, you can let them explain or check with other people so that you can serve them equitably.
That's all the time we have today on Living Healthy Together. Thank you, Dr. Sefakor and Heather, Krista and Heidi, Janet and Brian, and Greta Irwin for sharing your stories and insights around occupational therapy and its impact on lives across our region. We'll link to Dr. Sefakor's memoir in the episode description, so if you're listening to the podcast version of Living Healthy Together, you can check that out. And don't forget to subscribe. If you have questions, thoughts, or ideas for a future episode, send us an email at healthtalk@uvmhealth.org. We love hearing from you. I'm your host, Philip Rao. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.